How would you like to attend a conference and hear Matt Harrison, Craig Parton, Jonathan Fisk, Will Wheaton, Chris Roseborough, and Al Schmidt? You're invited to the 2014 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. Registration is $100 per person. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org.
We don't take our agenda from the polls. We don't take our agenda from what the world is saying. Our agenda is given us by the God who made us.
The media put this out as you cannot have religious liberty or you are an anti-gay bigot.
You see the president of Planned Parenthood confusing the empirical question, what is the unborn and when does life begin, with her own philosophical worldview.
The Christian husband learns what it is to be a husband who loves his wife as Christ loved the church by experiencing how he is not like Christ.
On-demand listeners of Issues Etc. love hearing sound theology while walking the dog.
I guess people wonder about this all the time, don't they? When you have the account of the Old Testament, the Old Testament scriptures, and it's full of different places and names and events. Now, it's not written, it is history, but it's not written as a history book. And you turn to the back and you look at the maps, you can see all these places. But what about the people? What about the people that are mentioned there in the Old Testament? We're unsure about some of the places. This was a long time ago, and names change and memories fade, but what about the people? Has biblical archaeology been able to confirm the existence of people in the Old Testament? And if so, how many? Well, the Biblical Archaeology Review Journal says in a headline, archaeology confirms 50 real people in the Bible. And they say, wow, 50 people. But that is relatively few of the so many people that are mentioned in the Old Testament. For this second hour of Issues Etc., on this Thursday afternoon, March the 13th, we're going to be talking about some of those who are confirmed archaeologically in the Old Testament. Also, for the ongoing search for Mount Sinai. You know, you think you'd be able to find a mountain. But apparently, archaeology has a lot of contenders for the Old Testament Mount Sinai. We'll find out what some of them are. Dr. Andrew Steinman will join us. You can join us as well. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email right here in the studio. We get them in real time. Talk back at issuesetc.org or a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Andrew Steinman is a regular guest. He's distinguished professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago, and author of the book From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. Dr. Steinman, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd.
Should we be surprised that so, well, to me it seems relatively few of all the people mentioned in the Old Testament, relatively few have been located archaeologically?
No, we really shouldn't be surprised, because a lot of the people that we read about in the Old Testament weren't extremely prominent in their day. Even somebody as rich as Abraham, you know, he's not a king. He's not a high priest or something like that. So, you know, usually when we read about people from antiquity, from sources outside the Bible, It's kings or occasionally a high priest or maybe even occasionally a court official that we know about. And these 50 people that you mentioned that are listed in Biblical Archaeology Review mainly fall into those categories. And so when we're reading about somebody like Boaz or Ruth or even some of David's wives or something like that, it shouldn't surprise us that we have names in the Bible that we don't have recorded outside the Bible, or we've never found, let's put it that way, recorded outside the Bible.
So they're not. It's not like I can research my family's history, and there were records kept at churches and in hospitals and immigration, things like that. We're kind of a very careful record-keeping society. We're talking about very old records, and many of which people just didn't get recorded.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I've done quite a lot of genealogical research on my family, and you know, I only have one line that I can take very far back. I have one line that I can take back to about 1680. But my family was mostly German peasants, and before 1680 and before the 40 Years' War, there just aren't any records. There's no way I'm going to go back any further because my family wasn't prominent. On the other hand, I've been able to take my wife's family back all the way to Charlemagne because she's of royal descent, so I guess I married well.
Sounds like you did. Let's start with David. That's where the BAR article starts as well. There was a long time, I take it, where not only archaeologists, but maybe even biblical scholars wondered why there seemed to be so little evidence for such a prominent figure in the Old Testament.
Yeah, and that this even led to some more skeptical scholars saying that there was no David, that the Israelites made him up so that they could have some great king in their past, and they made up their history and, you know, invented this guy David. You know, there was a inscription found in the late 20th century in what used to be the city of Dan in northern Israel, and it mentioned the House of David, the dynasty founded by David. And there was also another inscription that was actually found in the late 19th century, but was damaged. Before it was damaged, reverse copy was made, what's called a squeeze. They took paper and squeezed it into the inscription, so it had kind of a mirror image. And somebody went back, a scholar in France, took the squeeze that's in the Louvre and went back and looked at it again and found out, oh, this inscription also mentions the House of David. So we now have at least two inscriptions that tell us about this dynasty founded by David and confirms him. So for years, you had some skeptical biblical scholars saying, you know, this was just all fiction. Well, now it turns out it's not fiction at all. It really is true history. David did exist.
You mentioned extra biblical accounts and records, which is what we're dealing with here, obviously. I mean, it's not enough to say, hey, there's David in the Bible. We're corroborating his existence through other records that somehow survive. What's the nature of these records, by and large? What are we looking at? Are we looking at other kings' interactions with these people? What are we looking at?
Many of them are indeed other kings' interactions. Inscriptions from Egypt, inscriptions from Babylon or Assyria, or other things like that, kind of carved in stone or painted on walls. Occasionally, for some biblical people, because of things that have turned up in Jerusalem and its environments, we actually have seals of officials. You know, official records were usually sealed with a signet ring of a person, and so we have, in some cases, the seal, the document didn't survive, but the seal, which was made of clay and maybe dried and even baked in a fire when Jerusalem was burned, when Babylon conquered Jerusalem, sometimes we have these seals, and we can read the name on them of certain court officials in the kingdom of Judah. Some late things we have have to do with coins. Coinage didn't come into existence until the Persian era. So some of the later people during the Persian era, coins also help us for them. For some of the Babylonian kings that are mentioned in the Bible, we have the records that archaeologists have found from Babylon that are written in cuneiform. And one case, we actually have a bowl that was inscribed with a man's name on it, and that man is mentioned in Nehemiah. So there's a variety of things that we can look at to verify the existence of these people. Very seldom do we have written records on paper or what they used for paper before there was paper, papyrus. Although in one case, we actually have a papyrus a letter that confirms somebody we read about in Nehemiah.
Another of the figures that is prominent after David, Hezekiah. has also been confirmed. What's the nature of the evidence on him?
Well, we have seals that mentioned Hezekiah, and we also have jar handles. Apparently when the king taxed people, of course, they didn't have coinage in Hezekiah's day, so they were taxed on the produce. And we have seals that were kind of pressed into handles of, like, jars of wheat or jugs of wine. Some of them say to the king, and some of them actually say to King Hezekiah, meaning belonging to King Hezekiah. And apparently this was the taxation that was collected and put in these jars, and probably used for the royal household as food and drink.
One of the things mentioned in the BAR article is so-called snack ribs prism.
Yeah,
and it mentions Hezekiah in a. It actually kind of confirms, in a very passing way, some of the events associated with Hezekiah's life.
Yeah, Sennacherib's prism mentions that. Sennacherib came down and besieged Jerusalem, and it actually talks about shutting up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage when Jerusalem was besieged. Of course, the biblical account tells us that Sennacherib's army was devastated by an angel of the Lord who goes through the camp, and Sennacherib had to retreat, and it kind of confirms that. Now, the Sennacherib, like all Near Eastern kings, is not going to admit that he was defeated. He's never going to put up an inscription like that. They just didn't do that. But instead, what is interesting is he claims to have conquered and wiped out other cities. But with Jerusalem, the only thing he claims is to have besieged it. He never claims to conquer it or having it wiped out or anything like that. Which, in a way, confirms the biblical account that God, through his angel, lifted the siege around Jerusalem.
I mean, they were all about taking credit for their victories, sometimes even taking credit for victories that didn't exist. So had he conquered Jerusalem, contrary to the biblical account, he certainly would have had that one recorded.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. They would definitely record real victories, and like you said, occasionally they would take credit for victories they didn't have, or sometimes, you know, we have even inscriptions where two kings met and the battle was kind of a stalemate and they both claim victory, you know. So they never were defeated. They're never going to admit to defeat.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. We're doing a little biblical archaeology, talking about people confirmed archaeologically in the Bible, and a little bit later in our conversation on this Thursday afternoon, we'll talk about the ongoing archaeological and historical search for Mount Sinai.
Does your church need a backup organist? The Virtual Organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Greetings in Christ, and thank you for listening to Issues, etc. If you ever find yourself visiting the Smoky Mountains in East Tennessee, please join us here at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Sevierville. We see it as a small part of our service to the church to provide sound liturgical worship opportunities for vacationing Lutherans to our area. For worship times and directions, please visit our website at splctn.com. That's splctn.com.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Christ at the Center, The Justification of the Ungodly, A Contemporary View of Faith and Reason, The Holy Spirit in Christ. These are just some of the almost 30 essays included in Propter Christum, Christ at the Center. It's a new book of essays in honor of Issues, Etc. regular guest, Pastor Daniel Preuss. Find out more and purchase Propter Christum at shop.logia.org. Propter Christum, Christ at the Center, shop.logia.org.
In Higher Things, we believe that if you put good Christ crucified for you Lutheranism into a youth, you'll get a good Christ crucified for you Lutheran youth. Join us this July at the Higher Things Crucified Youth Conferences in Florida, Wisconsin, Utah. Check us out at www.higherthings.org. Higherthings.org. Dare your youth to be Lutherans this summer.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Thursday afternoon, March the 13th. We're talking about some news in biblical archaeology reported by Biblical Archaeology Review. One article having to do with 50 people who have been confirmed archaeologically from the biblical account as well. In a few minutes, the search for Mount Sinai. Dr. Steinman, one of the things that maybe we should mention here is that the Bible mentions people who nobody even has to search for archaeologically, like Sennacherib. You don't have to go looking for a guy like this, but is there a kind of an apologetic force for the fact that the Bible mentions them, calls them by name, and locates them correctly in history?
Yeah, I think that the last point you make is very important. One could argue if they just mentioned Nebuchadnezzar or one of the Egyptian pharaohs or somebody like that, that it might not be historically accurate. But what is so compelling about the Bible's mention of these people is it situates them correctly in history and relative to other well-known people in history. Nebuchadnezzar was a great king. He was known several centuries later, and somebody made up a story about him, but they get the details wrong. We don't have that. What we have is people situated at the right spot at the right time. With these kings of Egypt and Persia and Babylon and Assyria.
There are other kings that are mentioned here, but since we're talking about those foreign leaders relative to the people of the Old Testament, we find Nebuchadnezzar mentioned, and there he is in the archaeological record. How would you describe the evidence there?
Yeah, well, we have a number of things. We have evidence of Nebuchadnezzar's own court records about his besieging Jerusalem, for instance. That's very important because it confirms not only Nebuchadnezzar's existence, but also confirms what the Bible says about him coming up against Jerusalem. And in fact, if we looked at all the evidence for Nebuchadnezzar, we have overwhelming evidence, extra-biblical evidence for his existence, but the fact that we have evidence that directly confirms what the Bible says about his coming to Jerusalem and confirms the time that the Bible says it happened. It situates it in the same years that the Bible situates it, I think is very important because it tells us that what Jeremiah and what the book of Kings and the book of Chronicles and the book of Daniel say about Nebuchadnezzar besieging Jerusalem is absolutely accurate.
One question I think people have, since we were talking a little bit earlier about David, we mentioned Hezekiah as well. Solomon, as a king, is described in the Old Testament as having, well, the kingdom has almost empire-like qualities to it, vast wealth, and his political connections are also noted as well. It's the high point in the monarchy, a very early high point in the monarchy.
Yeah.
For the kingdom of Israel, the still united kingdom of Israel. What about Solomon? Do we find his footprints archaeologically?
No, we have no extra biblical mention of Solomon. But actually, I think that makes sense given the setting of Solomon. Solomon is able to extend the empire of David precisely because it was a time when Egypt was weak, the people over Mesopotamia, like the Babylonians and the Assyrians, were weak, and they are not interacting with other nations. They have enough just tending to their internal stuff. And so they don't leave a lot of records from this period about their interaction with other kingdoms. So it's not surprising that we don't have an Egyptian record about Solomon or a Assyrian record about Solomon or something like that, because it's in this period of time when there are actually a number of what we might call mini empires, Israel among them, that grow up here in this kind of time of power vacuum in the ancient Near East.
So the fact that we, and we should say, have not yet found archaeological evidence, direct archaeological evidence for Solomon, shouldn't alarm us too much. What about the personages surrounding Solomon that are mentioned in his account, other foreign leaders?
Yeah, well, we do have, that he marries a daughter of Pharaoh. It was actually very unusual that the pharaohs would marry off a daughter to a foreign king, but during this period they're rather weak. But they don't often keep records about who they married their daughters off to. They're not really interested in other kings and things like that if they can't glorify themselves. Somebody like the Queen of Sheba, well, you know, even the place called Sheba is a little bit controversial about what that exactly means and where she came from. So since we don't know for sure what the place is that is being referred to, it's pretty hard to go there and find an inscription that mentions her because, you know, you don't know where for sure to look. So
it's a big place, right?
Yeah. Sheba could be on the Arabian Peninsula. This is where it's usually put, maybe someplace like Yemen or someplace like that. But then there have been claims for places in Africa, too. And so, you know, where do you go look? And you got to cast a really wide net. And if we found something, my guess would be almost an accident that we found it.
Let's talk a little bit about a man that is very prominent in the Old Testament in terms of kind of the significant foreign king, Cyrus. What do we have on him archaeologically?
We have the Cyrus cylinder, which is very important because it talks about Cyrus conquering lands and allowing people to return to their native lands, or allowing gods, idols that were captured, to return to their native temples. So we know that not only Cyrus existed, and we have plenty of proofs, and you can even go see his tomb in Persia if you can get into Persia and into Iran, but we also know that his policy of allowing the Judeans to return and rebuild the temple in Jerusalem fits precisely with the policy that he outlines in this so-called Cyrus cylinder that has been found. So, again, it kind of doesn't confirm the specific decree allowing the Judeans to come back, but it does confirm that this is not out of character with what Cyrus did.
One archaeological connection to the Book of Esther, I know that's of special interest to you, has also been found, although by a different name. What is it?
You're talking about the King Xerxes?
Yes.
Yeah, we have a number of things from Xerxes, and we've known him by his Greek name, by the way. That's where he gets his Greek name, Xerxes. We know him in the Bible as Ahasuerus, and that's because his name was very hard to pronounce. His name was in Old Persian. Old Persian has a strange combination of sounds for many people, and the Greeks ended up calling him Xerxes, and the Hebrews ended up calling him Ahasuerus. But we do have all of these monarchs of this period in Persia documented in many ways, and especially Xerxes is important. We have all kinds of records about Xerxes because he tries to invade Europe and go across the Bosporus. We have ancient Greek accounts of Xerxes that the later Greek historians preserve. He's one of the best documented kings we have, and one of the most powerful Persian kings. So that shouldn't surprise us that we know a lot about him from any number of sources. By the way, we also have a monumental thing of a monumental inscription in Persia, in Iran, from one of his fellow Persian kings, and that's Darius the First. It's a great big inscription where Darius talks about conquering peoples and so forth, and Darius also is mentioned in the Bible. So these Persian kings are pretty well documented for us.
Stepping back, look, and we mentioned before the pharaohs, going farther back in history to the time of the Exodus, can we find any, and we really are talking a very long time ago, can we find any evidence to make archaeological connections to the biblical claims of the Exodus event?
No, there's nothing directly talking about the Exodus from Egypt. And again, it shouldn't surprise us because the pharaohs don't talk about their defeats. And very clearly, Pharaoh was defeated in this. But it's interesting that we do have probably the oldest mention of Israel in a stele, a big inscription that's in the museum in Cairo, that was put up by Pharaoh Merneptah, and Merneptah makes mention of Israel in the land. And from this, we know when Israel had to have already been in the land for some time and established as a people. This is how the inscription refers to them, as a people. So we know they had to be in the land and established in the people in Merneptah's day, which means it's only reasonable to think that the Exodus took place about the time that the Bible says it did, about 1440 B.C., in order for them to go out, be in the wilderness for 40 years, come in and conquer the land under Joshua and get established by the time Merneptah comes up to invade Israel and invade the land and find Israel there.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. We're talking biblical archaeology on this Thursday afternoon, March the 13th. People confirmed archaeologically in the Bible, and in a few minutes, the search for Mount Sinai. He's distinguished professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago, and author of the book From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. We'll hear a little bit about that book when we come back. Where do we find Jesus in the book of Job? I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Job in 4 Not-So-Easy Steps. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues Etc. journal. Just look for the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. Pastor Ross Johnson has written our Wittenberg Trail feature. It's titled Lutheranism, Christianity's Best Kept Secret, the free online Issues Etc. journal.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
Here are two new ways that you can promote Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. business card and the Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer. Simply go to the support page at issuesetc.org, click Issues Etc. business cards, print the page on suitable stock paper, and cut along the lines. We also have an 8.5 by 11-inch flyer for the bulletin board at your church. issuesetc.org, go to the support page, click Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer, and print.
Hey, St. Louis. How would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
Streaming 24/7 sacred music and talk stations from a 500-square-foot office in Collinsville, Illinois, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania. Zion Lutheran, Detroit, Michigan. St. Paul's Lutheran, Long Beach, California. All Saints Lutheran, Charlotte, North Carolina. Redeemer Lutheran, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Shepherd of the Lake Lutheran, Garrison, Minnesota. Emmanuel Lutheran, Kansas City, Missouri. And Holy Cross Lutheran, St. Genevieve, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. We're talking about people confirmed archaeologically from the biblical text and the search for Mount Sinai. Dr. Andrew Steinman is Distinguished Professor of Theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago, and he's also authored the book From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. Dr. Steinman, tell us a little bit about that book.
Well, this is a book that traces all the evidence for what happened when in the Bible, from the time of Abraham all the way through the end of the ministry of Paul as we have it in the Bible. It discusses how we know these things took place, also discusses various theories that people have date things, and then, of course, I take a stand on which theory is the correct theory and why. It's written kind of for an informed lay audience, or obviously for pastors and others too, to use so that they can know that when we're reading the Bible and we're reading what the Bible presents as history, it's not just making up history, it's actually presenting us with real historical facts, and we can know when they happened and indeed oftentimes where they happened, and that the Bible is indeed presenting us with the work of God in history.
Folks, you can find out more about this great book, From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. I highly recommend it. It's a great resource. At our website, issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand, or give Concordia Publishing House a call and order From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Dr. Steinman, let's talk a little bit. We've kind of talked about the at least in terms of the Israelite kings, the good guys. There's a bad guy too, Ahaz, I believe, although mentioned by a different name. Is there, I take it from the BAR article, that there's also evidence for him as well?
Yeah, there are, and for a lot of these kings of Israel that we know about, and Ahaz included, there are inscriptions from foreign kings, like the Assyrians and so forth, that mention their interaction with these kings. So we have these kings that are mentioned, say, when the Assyrians come in and subjugate them and demand that they pay taxes and tribute to them. And we have pictures of some of these kings even sometimes. For instance, there is, not with Ahaz, but with Jehu, one of the other kings of the northern kingdom, we have what's called the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser III, which actually depicts either King Jehu or one of his servants bowing down before Shalmaneser as he comes to present the tribute that's demanded. That's quite a striking thing. So with Ahaz, and Uzziah, Manasseh, Jehoiakim, all those guys of Judah, we've been able to confirm them archaeologically, and some of these kings of the northern kingdom too.
Now, we're talking here, and I want to note this before we move on to the subject of Mount Sinai. We're talking about, in the BAR article, those 50 that can be absolutely confirmed with the, you know, the kind of certainty that archaeology can provide. It's not an absolute certainty, but they can be, we can say, look, this is good, strong evidence. There are more for which the evidence is perhaps iffy. And so you don't want to say yes or no on it, aren't there?
Yeah. For instance, we know from the 1970s an inscription that mentions the prophet Balaam that was found east of the Jordan River. This, you know, is obviously talking about Balaam, son of Beor, the same guy that's mentioned in the book of Numbers as being hired to prophesy against Israel. But it's just this one inscription. It's much later than his time and doesn't describe him exactly the same way as in the Bible. So a lot of scholars are reluctant to say this is confirmation of his existence, although it's highly suggestive. Another fellow is Shebna, who was the overseer of the palace in Jerusalem in Isaiah's day, and Isaiah condemns him for building for himself a tomb hewn out of rock. And we actually have a rock-hewn tomb in Jerusalem with an inscription above it that talks about a fellow who was over the palace who built his tomb. Unfortunately, only the last part of the name is preserved in the inscription, but it matches the last part of Shebna's name. So I'm probably 99% sure that we actually know where the grave of this Shebna was that Isaiah condemned, but we can't be 100% certain because, unfortunately, the inscription is broken precisely at the point that would confirm the name of this man.
And we haven't even really mentioned, although we should just to kind of cap off this part of our conversation, we haven't even mentioned the New Testament and the archaeological evidence, extra-biblical evidence for the events, the places, and the people there.
Yeah, and you know, it's quite dramatic at times. You know, there were scholars who doubted the existence of Pontius Pilate, who's, you know, obviously a major person in the gospel accounts. And there were 19th century German scholars who were saying, oh, this is all made up by Christians later on. They needed a bad guy, and so they made up Pontius Pilate. Well, in the 1960s, an inscription came to light, and lo and behold, this is a dedicatory inscription by Pontius Pilate, the procurator of Judea. So now we have, you know, evidence for this man that so many people doubted. And we have other New Testament people, too, that have been confirmed. Of course, some of them are pretty obvious, like the Roman emperors. Of course, we knew about them all along. But some of them are a little bit more obscure, and yet we have records that have come out to confirm their existence of these New Testament people.
Let's turn to the issue of geography. And very often, I remember being a kid bored in, I don't know, church or confirmation class, turning to the back of the Bible where all the maps were. And some of the places are unmistakable, like Jerusalem. You can't miss that one because the city on its spot persists to this day, even with the same name, more or less. And other places, especially like the geographical features like mountains, we have a really good idea where most of them were. Mount Sinai kind of would always have a little spot there in the Sinai Peninsula with a question mark next to it. And I remember being a kid thinking, why can't they find a mountain? How do you lose a mountain? What's the problem with locating Sinai?
Well, the problem is that, you know, it was never continuously occupied, and it was in the middle of a desert, so we only have a general description of its location in the Bible. We know, for instance, that Moses, who was son-in-law to the priests of Midian, was tending his the sheep on the other side of the desert, we're told, which must mean the other side of the desert from Midian, when he came to the burning bush on Mount Sinai. So it tells us that it has to be somewhere in the vicinity of Midian, probably. Even as late as the New Testament, Paul says Mount Sinai is a mountain in Arabia. Now, when Paul says Arabia, in his day, he means something a little bit different than what we mean by Saudi Arabia nowadays. But even so, it gives us some idea where Mount Sinai should be. So we have a general location, but we simply don't have any specific information in the Bible as to its exact location, and no continuous occupation in and around Mount Sinai that would allow us to say, well, we know this because it's been there forever and ever, like Jerusalem or Damascus or one of the other places mentioned in the Old Testament.
What are the contenders for Mount Sinai? How many different possibilities, credible possibilities, do archaeologists or ancient historians consider?
Well, there's depending on what you consider credible, up to five. The kind of traditional site that you'll see on many maps called Jebel Musa, which is Arabic for the Mountain of Moses, is down south in the Sinai Peninsula. There's a monastery there, St. Catherine's Monastery, and for centuries it has been kind of the traditional site of Mount Sinai. But that's only since the mid-3rd century after Christ. You know, so you're talking 300 years after Jesus, somebody's identifying this place as Mount Sinai. It doesn't really go all the way back to Moses in the identification. That's an interesting site. I've been there myself to the monastery, and the monks will show you a well where they say Moses drove off the men who were bothering Zipporah and her sisters, and you know he ends up marrying Zipporah, and they'll show you a bush and say this was the burning bush, you know. But it's all very fanciful. It's a nice place. You can hire Bedouin to take you up. I did this. You can hire Bedouin take you up to the top of the mountain and see the sunrise. And it's absolutely gorgeous up there to see the sunrise. Unfortunately, on the way down, my wife fell and broke her arm.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yes, it was a long flight home, let's say that. But, you know, so you can go there to this traditional site of Mount Sinai, and many people have. But it's probably not the best contender because it's so far away from the land of the Midianites. And so this is why this article has come out with probably four other sites that have been proposed in the last decades to be the real Mount Sinai.
Dr. Andrew Steinman's our guest. We'll take another break when we come back. 10 more minutes with him as we talk about the search for Mount Sinai. It's Thursday afternoon, March the 13th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+. Simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
Folks attending last year's Making the Case conference absolutely loved the barbecue from Randy's House of Barbecue in Troy and Highland, Illinois. The pork, chicken, ribs, and beef are prepared just like the old days in a pit cooked over hickory, apple, and wild cherry wood. Randy's House of Barbecue, Route 40 and Troy O'Fallon Road in Troy, and at 2649 Northtown Way in Highland. Randy's House of Barbecue, randysbbq.com.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The dangers inherent in particularly Lutheran Reformation Christians trying to be Baptists in their worship approach.
Craig Parton talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Just at the moment, a lot of people, Baptists and evangelicals included, are looking for more substance in their worship life. Many of them are looking to helpful liturgies and the hymns of the church to bring content to their services. Lutherans are throwing that stuff off the deck of the boat as fast as they can do it. So there'll be some comments, some discussion about why that's a dangerous avenue for Lutherans to take.
You can meet and hear Craig Parton making the case against Lutherans imitating evangelicals June 13th and 14th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, just look for the Making the Case logo at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the search for Biblical Mount Sinai. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. Dr. Steinman, you said that there are four others, without going through all of them in detail. The latest article in Biblical Archaeology Review is arguing for a location called Har Karkum. What's there?
Yeah, well, this is a mountain that is not extraordinarily high, but is surrounded by a lot of interesting features, including a lot of petroglyphs that have been left by people who were there. There's been an archaeologist who's been working this site for a number of years, and according to him, many of these inscriptions come from the right time. And may have been left by Israelites or others who passed through and revered this mountain. Har Karkum is hard to describe on the map on the radio, but it's kind of on the border between Egypt and Israel. It's very southern Israel, very far east in the Sinai Peninsula that's controlled by Egypt. And there he's been doing this archaeology and trying to make a claim for this mountain as Mount Sinai.
Do you think that it fits the criteria of at least being relatively near to where Moses would have been prior to his call when he's, you know, for 40 years a Midianite shepherd?
Well, it's certainly much better fit than the traditional Mount Sinai. I have my doubts about whether it's the best fit. But it certainly is a much better candidate than that. The Midianites lived kind of on the western edge of the Arabian Peninsula, in what we might now call west and kind of northwest Saudi Arabia, in that area. So Har Karkum would be a little bit far away, but not inaccessible to somebody like Moses, but it seems to me that Moses was going a long way with those sheep if that's where he was when he encountered the burning bush.
Is there a better candidate, in your opinion, for Mount Sinai?
Well, yeah, there are several mountains in the area of Midian. There's a place called Timnah, which probably isn't a bad candidate. And I think probably that there are a number of mountains in that area, and we probably will never know for sure unless we come up with an inscription that says Moses was here or something like that, we will know for sure which mountain that actually was. I think it's probably, you know, on the very western edge of the Sinai Peninsula somewhere. Some of the other candidates that are further down into Saudi Arabia, I think we're probably too far away for the Israelites to go, too far away for Elijah. You know, we know Elijah went to Mount Sinai. This is where he has this famous encounter with God, where God's in the still, small voice. So I think probably something in the region of this mountain called Timnah is probably the real Mount Sinai, but again, that's just an educated guess.
Now, that kind of raises the question of what would constitute strong evidence for this. Given the nature of the event with which it's associated, mostly, the events, the call of Moses, that doesn't, you know, we're not going to find Moses' bare footprint sitting around any place there by a bush that still exists. And then the return of the people there. How long were the people actually camped at Mount Sinai?
Well, they were probably there a year or less. I mean, they you know, when we read the book of Exodus, they get there about 3 months after they leave Egypt, and they're there for about a year before they move out with the first aborted attempt to conquer the land. And this is recorded in the book of Numbers. So the end of the book of Exodus, or last half of the book of Exodus, we might say, all of Leviticus and the beginning of Numbers take place at Mount Sinai. And so we've got, let's say, approximately a year at Mount Sinai. So they could have left some trace, but remember, we're talking quite a few years ago now. We're talking 3,500 years ago. So it's hard, if you've only been there a year, to leave substantial amount of artifacts around. And, you know, if you did find things like pottery, unless, it was, again, it was a pot that was inscribed, this belonged to the high priest Aaron, or something like that, it could have been anybody that, at a particular place and time, that left pottery around, even if the pottery fits the right time period.
Would you be, I guess what you're looking for then, would it be piles of basically what we'd call garbage? Would you be looking for the garbage heap of a camp of, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of a million people for a year?
Yeah, that's exactly what you'd be looking for. And you would look for the stuff they threw out. The problem is, what would they have thrown out? Because, you know, specifically we're told when they come into the land and you know, are getting ready to come into the land, Moses reminds them, you've been in the wilderness 40 years and your clothes haven't worn out. God's preserved your clothes. So how much clothes would they have thrown out? They were fed on manna, so how much other food will we find, food waste will we find, like bones of animals and stuff like that? We might find some bones of animals from sacrifices that they were required to make. But again, they were only there a year. It's not like we're finding 50 or 80 years of sacrificial bones. So you would look for the garbage dump. But even if you found it, it's not going to be substantial. And that shouldn't surprise us, even if it's not the garbage dump of the Israelites, because this is out in desert area. You're probably not going to find too many substantial garbage dumps.
So they probably, what you're saying, it sounds like what you're saying here is, even staying there a year, even in the numbers that they were, they may not have left enough stuff behind for archaeologists to first locate and then identify, to be able to say, this mountain where we found at the foot of this mountain a big garbage dump is Sinai.
Right. I mean, they're just not likely, if you trust the biblical account of what God provided for them, they're not likely to leave a lot behind. I mean, it would be nice maybe if we found the smashed tablets of the law that Moses smashed. That might be good evidence. But, again, that would be a really chance find to find something like that.
How important is it that a key event in all of biblical history, we don't exactly know where it is, even though it's a mountain? How important is that?
I'm not sure it's important overall as to establishing the historicity of things, because keep in mind, even if we look at non-biblical events, there are oftentimes we don't know where things are. And the one that comes to mind is the tomb of Alexander the Great. Now, here's a man who's well known to history. We even know that he was buried somewhere in or around Alexandria, Egypt, and yet we still have no idea where his tomb was. You know, that doesn't lead anybody to say, well, Alexander the Great was made up, or his tomb really wasn't in Alexandria. I don't know of any scholars to take that viewpoint. So for the same reason, I don't know why we should doubt what is told us about Mount Sinai. If there's one tradition in the Old Testament that is repeated and consistently portrayed in the Psalms, in the Pentateuch, and in many of the other books of the Old Testament, it's the events at Mount Sinai. So it's not like, you know, this is a small event that we can't locate. It's a big event, and there's a persistent tradition in the Bible that it actually took place. So I don't think not knowing exactly where it took place is a deal breaker.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is a distinguished professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago. He's author of the book From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. Dr. Steinman, thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Well, tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking with Pastor Scott Stiegemeyer, beginning a series with him, in fact, on God's gift of marriage. He's co-authored the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, Your Marriage by God's Design. This is a great primer on what marriage is, God's gift of marriage. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for Your Marriage by God's Design. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
When you need a friend, you have a friend in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd, and friends among His people at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri. At Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, we offer Christ-centered word and sacrament ministry, inspirational liturgical worship services, and faithful preaching and teaching. Sunday worship services are at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible class are at 10:30. We also have an excellent Christian preschool. We invite you to join us. Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 2211 Tenbrook Road, Arnold, Missouri, 636-296-1292.
What is God's purpose for marriage? How should we respond when traditional marriage is openly mocked as irrelevant? The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March is titled Your Marriage by God's Design. It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guests Scott and Julie Stiegemeyer. You can find out more about Your Marriage by God's Design at issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Your Marriage by God's Design, The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month.